You know, it's not without trepidation and fear that I've approached this text. I've never preached on this text before that I can remember. I have no record of it. And I don't come to this story at 64 and think I've got this, because I don't, and I must ask if it has gripped me. That's always the approach to the Scriptures. It is the only miracle in Jesus' ministry that is presented in all four Gospels. This is the only one. The Gospels just seem to kind of shove it in our face. All four. It's a miracle of meeting the physical needs of people. I mean, there's a great social need of hunger. People lack food. People need nourishment. Just like in the desert with the Israelites. People need us, our Redeemer Presbyterian Church, to stack the food bank shelf as you enter the church and to grab a homeless bag as you exit the church to meet the needs of hungry people. People have basic needs, and Jesus is faced with group hunger. And maybe not world hunger here, but his action, recorded in all the Gospels, tells us his ear is turned to growling stomachs. Please notice that Jesus does not pass out flyers here promoting fasting. He feeds. And please notice the contrast here between Jesus and Herod. We didn't read about Herod. It was a beautiful fall day in October. It was 1970, and I was 8 years old. And I was overwhelmed with my house on that beautiful fall day, jammed with wailing people because my dad had died that day. And I didn't know it, and I came home from school, and it was packed. It happened on the golf course. So I dismissed myself, and I walked a block to Jerry's, needing some alone time. And notice, I'm 8 years old. I'm just outside of Detroit, and I just go down the road a whole block. That's what would happen when I grew up. My mom would say, I don't know what we're going to do or where we're going to be. And she'd say, well, when you see the streetlights come on, you need to come home. That was my world. So I went to Jerry's house. And his mom, Marge, she raised 10 kids in a space of living space of about 1,300 square feet with one bathroom. There was a cement basement that some of the older guys stayed down, and they made walls out of milk cartons. She was this wonderful lady who worshiped at the Catholic Church, and she greeted me at the door, and she threw her arms around me, and she cried while whispering this beautiful prayer over my head. Well, Herod, just prior to our Bible story, he's having a banquet. He is having a party to celebrate his birthday. It's all about Herod, not about the people he's elected to serve. Herod's a narcissist. Beautiful women around him, power, glamour, gold, statues of himself. Herod, that's Herod. Herod used his power and position to make a dark decree. Herod's hormones pronounced profound punishment on John the Baptist. His loins stirred watching Herodias' daughter dance. Not moved by moral character or ancient wisdom or the counsel of scholars, he promises the dancing girl just any wish. His hormones trump ethics. He grants the dancing girl her request of the head of Jesus' cousin, John the Baptist. On a platter. Our feeding story opens with Jesus hearing about that situation, about that event, about John's death. So he goes to a solitary place for alone grieving time. That's what I was attempting to do in October. I needed to get away. I needed to get out. But the crowds got wind of Jesus hiding, taking the boat, so they followed Jesus. Jesus didn't push them away. He didn't graciously tell them I need my alone time. He had compassion on them. He healed their sick. He healed their wretchedness. That's the word wretchedness. It's the only place in the Bible that it's used. It's right here. It's more wretchedness than sick, but it gets translated sick. Matthew goes out of his way in his gospel to connect following Jesus with experiencing miracles. We're going to talk about that. With experiencing signs beyond coincident events. And when Matthew edits the tradition in his letter, there's a tradition and he's looking over things and he's putting it together and he edits it a little bit. And wherever we see him editing, in every case, following Jesus is always prior to experiencing the unimaginable, the miracle. It's like we are being told, you follow Jesus first, friends. You follow him first. And then we will experience, along the way, unexplainable things. Peter Kraft has influenced me. Raised Presbyterian, went to Calvin College. But it didn't stick. It's his senior year. He converted to the Catholic faith, and he's 89 now. He was married 63 years, taught, still teaches full-time at Boston College at 89. His wife died May 31st this year. He's a quirky, absent-minded professor, and he'll tell you that. He and his wife hate technology. They only use flip phones. 10 years ago, his wife didn't even want that, so she closed her flip phone and closed the account, and she said, I'm going to use yours, Peter, when I need to make a phone call. So Peter was sitting at his wife's wake. Okay, he's sitting at the wake. You can go on and listen to the interview. It's 3 hours long. It's fantastic. He's sitting at his wife's wake, and the priest was talking and grieving Kraft, being a brilliant ditz, forgot to turn off his phone at his own wife's wake. His little flip phone in his pocket. And it went off, causing a pausing disturbance in the holy ceremony of his wife. And he was embarrassed. He had to reach in his pocket. Everyone knew it was him. Embarrassed was he, as Yoda would say. And when he looked at the missed call, it was from his dead wife. It was from his dead wife. He called about this odd happening later on in the day, and he was told that the number was no longer in service and it's been canceled for 10 years, so they don't know what to think about it. He calls it his little miracle. His wife, who died, he said, is not dead. She called him at her wake, knowing he'd forget to turn off his phone and the joke would be on him. This philosopher of 130-plus books who passionately has followed Jesus his whole life laughs at this holy humor miracle. And he has many to tell along the way. Matthew wants us to open our eyes to the unexplainable happenings that leave the fingerprints of Christ as we follow him. But as the story continues, we discover we're a mixture of the disciples and the complaint of the Psalms, all of us. I cannot recall another place where the disciples seem as disrespectful to Jesus as right here in this story. I thought Dave did a great job reading. He pulled a lot of that out. The disciples, I'm sure, are peopled out while Jesus continues to love the people without any emotional gas in the tank. I mean, he's grieving. And the disciples are abrupt as they look around at their desolate, remote surroundings. They aren't relational with Jesus. They get bossy with Jesus. They start telling Jesus what to do. There's no respectful Lord. None of that. As one person says, they simply tell Jesus almost literally the time of day, as if Jesus was unaware, They describe the landscape as if Jesus was blind. And then they insult Jesus' decision-making ability by telling Jesus what to do. This is a remote place, they say. The sun is starting to set. Send them home because they must be hungry. That's what they said. And send is in the imperative. It's a command. They are commanding Jesus what to do. We are commanding you because it's obvious that you are too empathetic to this crowd while not being empathetic to your special group of 12. Again, you can compare the hedonist and narcissistic Herod with the empathetic Jesus. Praying through the Psalms, 150 Psalms, will teach us that at times being nice toward God is often dishonest. The Psalms give us the permission to get frustrated with God, who just so often seems to take his time. So in our own ways, we tell God what to do. Send them home so they can eat. But Jesus doesn't get mad at the disciples, and Jesus doesn't get mad at us. Jesus doesn't react in anger. He isn't like the teacher who takes a student's disrespect personally. Jesus isn't insecure. Your disrespect, Jesus is saying to the disciples, doesn't bother me because I know who I am. I know what I'm about. He says to the disciples, guys, they don't need to go away. Jesus believes the disciples can take care of the needs before them, and he adds, you give them something to eat. And the you is emphasized. You do it. I tend to think the disciples at this particular moment get kind of sarcastic with Jesus. The disciples get sarcastic with Jesus. Jesus doesn't ask them what they have or seek to brainstorm with them. He doesn't ask them that. What do you have? What do we have here? Notice that the disciples seem to be getting crankier. And again, there's no Lord. There's no attempt to have a respectful dialogue. I think their response went something like this. Jesus, you blind? Are you blind? There are just a mere 500 men. 500 men. 5,000 men. We 12 got that covered. And don't worry about the women and kids. If they have to go without, you explain it to them since you have such love for those at society's bottom, like the women and the children. But we'll figure out how to throw them a potluck dinner with an abundant 5 loaves of bread we purchased at Safeway before we left here for here and 2 16-inch bass we caught last night. We'll take care of it. That should be plenty. We have only a mere 5 loaves of bread and a couple of fish. You got to be kidding me. You do the math, Jesus, because we're going to do math this morning. Don't think we can't do basic math, Jesus. We have 7 hand-sized pieces of food, and it's going to take 7 times 5,000 to throw a banquet for all these people. And we just have 5 handfuls of food in one hand and then 2 pieces of fish in the other. Into the equation, Jesus. Because they're realists. They look at their city, we're realists. There's no way to feed this group with 7 small food items. It would impress the disciples if they had an abundance of food to work with because they live in the real world. But they have counted only 7 in their grocery cart. And they forgot to add the most important number to their predicament, Jesus. Should they be thinking about the 7 items or should they be thinking about number that's standing right before them? That's the title. Question mark. 7 or 8? Question mark. They're adding together only what is rational and realistic to them without counting, and then just counting Jesus out. I think of the Christmas dinner we had here. we hosted with His Helping Hands, we do it every Christmas, where we were running out of food. We were running out of food. I mean, there was panic. We underestimated the numbers that were flooding through our church door. The kitchen crew knew they had to keep serving while hoping and praying that Jesus would somehow multiply the dinner. And there was food left over for us the next day. We had our little church potluck. We were the 5,000 sitting down to eat because of what Jesus did. Renee said, it was like the story of Jesus and the loaves and the fish. That's what she said. We followed Jesus by providing hospitality. We were following Him. We were doing it for the marginalized, those in need, and the unexplainable descended on us. Okay, many like to play with biblical numbers, and I'm playing with 7 and 8. In the book of Revelation, we have that haunting number. 666, the mark of the beast. It's the mark of the Antichrist. You know, Ronald Reagan was suggested by speculators to be the Antichrist. You want to know why? Because his full name is Ronald Wilson Reagan. Each word has 6 letters in it. 666. That's how crazy people get with this stuff. Don't listen to them. Throw a rock through the TV if there's talking about it on TV. And if I ever did that in a church, throw a rock at me and put me out of my misery and put yourself out of your misery. In Revelation 13, 18, it says that 666 is the number of a man, but more literally, it's just a number of man, the number of humanity, the number of incompleteness. It's a human number. And so the whole book of giving analogies here, the number of completion or perfection in Scripture is 7. So off the whole book of Revelation, you get the 7 stars and the 7 gold planets and the 7 churches and the 7 spirits of God. Yeah, because it's the perfect number. And then in John, who also did Revelation, you get the 7 I am sayings of Jesus. And you probably get another one, even though He doesn't say I am. It's see the Son of Man going up and down on the ladder. He's the ladder, the angels coming down. He's the ladder, the connection between heaven and earth. The anti-Trinitarian counterfeit in the book of Revelation is the dragon, the beast out of the sea and the beast out of the earth, the unholy Trinity. But the Holy Trinity is numbered 777. All that our dark enemy does is seek to mimic Holy Trinity, 666, not the perfect 777. But our enemy is always less than perfection. But let's keep doing Sunday school math. There's more to think about. John's writing Revelation, and he works with this concept of Jewish gematria. He uses numbers to spell words. And if you take the name of Jesus in Greek and give the appropriate number to each letter in Jesus, and when I say give the appropriate number, it's like this. If you went A is 1, B is 2, C is 3, and you go up to J, which is 10, and then you would go K, 20, 100, and the next letter would be 200. That's the way they did it. And it just keeps going until you're at the end of the alphabet. And so my number is 151 in Jewish gematria. You could go home and figure out yours. Make a t-shirt, 151, that's my name. Well, when you take the name Jesus, it comes out to 888. 888. Jesus. Jesus. Daryl Johnson reflects on this and he pens, 7 is the number of completeness. 8 is one better. 3 8s are completely complete. Religion, the mark of the beast, it's the human number. It's the failure upon failure upon failure. Jesus is never fails, never fails, never fails. He's 888. He is the world's last hope. To see Jesus and reflect upon all that he reveals and does is to dive into the eternal mystery of the Trinity. The revelation of Jesus standing and gazing, my guess, grinning a bit as he sees five loaves and two fish displaying seven morsels of food. And those knuckle-headed disciples didn't even think to take into account the completely complete 888 standing right before them, the number eight. They didn't think about it. They failed to add beyond perfection, and they were trying to boss around perfection. They were working with the number seven, not the number eight. What about us? What about you and me? We all walk through the valley of the shadow of death daily, and we become limited in perspective because of the realistic obstacles staring in our face. And we all have obstacles staring in our face. I know your obstacles. We all have seven. I encourage us all to add him into our life's equations while following him, expecting the unexplainable. We get a story in the Old Testament. We read other stories, but I didn't want to go into one of those. I wanted to go into this one. This story tastes a lot like our multiplication of bread and fish story. God nudges Elijah to travel to Zarephath, where God has commanded a woman, a widow, to give him food and drink because sustenance has become scarce. And so Elijah finds his way to the town gate, and he notices this woman, and she's gathering sticks. And he asks her for a drink of water, and she's on her way to get this drink of water. And he says, oh, by the way, bring me some bread too. She pauses. She turns. And remember, she's been commanded by God. That's what it says at the very beginning of the story. And as she was responding to his request, he yelled that, and she lays out her dilemma. She has only enough flour and oil for a loaf. And then the process of dying with her son because her cupboards are empty and there's nothing in the land. And Elijah tells her, okay, God will provide. He'll somehow turn your seven into an eight. She would always have miraculously enough in her jars until God opens the heavens to soak the land with rain. The woman had to make a decision. Will she follow the leading of the Lord in this situation and lay feet on her explainable or discount Elijah's words to her? Be realistic. Feed her son one last time. She chose to add the Lord to her number seven and trust in number eight. She did what she could. She gave what she had, believing somehow God would change the answer to her math problem. Well, the disciples in Matthew 14, they gave Jesus what they had, the seven handfuls of food, and he did the rest. They gave Jesus what they had. God in Jesus Christ, by the presence of the Holy Spirit, is asking us if we have added him to our dilemmas, our crises, our problems, shown by us giving him what we have. I love the way Dale Bruner puts this. He says, we often feel that we have an insufficient 5 and 2 with which to address our personal 5,000. We are easily discouraged by realities that tell us we cannot cope. But the Christian faith is nothing if it is not a supernaturalism, if it can count only to 7, if it does not believe that Jesus is risen and can do things in our lives. I have a friend who pastors in Connecticut. He has a friend in his congregation named Matt. Matt works for groups around the globe. He builds buildings, hospitals, to underserved people. The Christian organization has their main headquarters in the States. He's worked for them for years. Matt's high school son some years back, died in a tragic car accident. Terrible. Nothing worse. Mac committed to following Jesus, though, in the midst of this extreme grief that he could not understand. And he just struggled and struggled. No answer to his pain. Months after his son's death, he traveled overseas for the opening of a health clinic that he was significant in seeing built. And the people named the building after him because they were just so grateful. During that time, it was in the first year of his son's death, you need to know that he had made the decision that the way he was going to make sure he stuck to what he needed to stick to and deal with what he needed to deal with, he wrote a letter to his dead son every day for 1 year. Every day. So he goes to this big celebration of the opening of this building. He goes back in this third world country to the kind of like the hut he was staying in, and he sat down with his letter, paper and pen, and he wrote a letter to his son. And in it, out of nowhere, he penned these words: "I so wish you were here today, son. Just to say you were so proud of your dad. Just to say you were proud of me. I'd love to hear that." He was home in Connecticut for a couple of weeks after this, after he wrote that letter. And he got a call from a girl his son hung out with. Not a girlfriend, just a really good friend. And she spoke into Matt's 7, strange what she was going to say. She didn't know what to do with it. But out of nowhere, she said, 10 days ago, she was sleeping and she had this vivid dream. And Matt was standing there and he was talking to her and they're having this dialogue. And the dead son said to his friend in this dream, "You know what? I am just so proud of my dad." The unexplainable. She told Matt, "It was just so weird. But for some reason, I just thought I should tell you." It doesn't take all the questions away. I'm going to ask if Katie and Melanie would come up to help serve communion at this time. Right now, please. Everyone, we come to this table and we come with 5 loaves and 2 fish to number 8, to Jesus. We do it every week. And we struggle sometimes to believe that number 8 makes a difference because we're such realists, just like the disciples. Well, the 8-8 Jesus, people, sit down. You're sitting. You're sitting right now. All 5,000 men plus women and children. And Jesus, he took the elements. He took the bread. There was 5 loaves. And he took it, and he lifted them to heaven. And he gave them to the Father. And he gives thanks. And he says to us, "This is my body broken for you. Never count me out. In all you're going through, do not count me out. I was broken for you. All 5,000 plus women and children." And he lifted it to heaven, giving them to the Father, and he gave thanks. And then he took wine, and he gave it to his disciple, Katie. And he gives it to his disciple, Melanie. Because his blood was poured out. We taste his we taste this wine and we come to Christ. We come to Christ, the perfect 888. So as we come to the Eucharist table this morning for the forgiveness of sin, to the meal to feed on Jesus, and we're counting Him in. We're counting Him in to our only 5 loaves and 2 fish with 5,000 things that stand in the way of us seeing the unexplainable. And Jesus breaks the bread. And He breaks the fish and He gives it to all those people. That's the gospel. Maybe we should put a big 8 on the communion table. The body and blood of Christ for the people of God.